Welcome to Whistleblowers, episode 14. My name's Greg Kerr. Today's episode, Roger the Dodger.
Detectives jailed for life for the murder of 20-year-old drug dealer Jamie Gow. Roger Rogerson and fellow ex-cop Glenn McNamara plotted to kill Gow to steal almost 3 kilograms of the drug ice. They thought they got away with it.
The joint criminal enterprise to which each offender was a party was extensive in its planning, brutal in its execution, and callous in its aftermath.
But the evidence presented during the 4-month trial was overwhelming. Security cameras covering almost every move. One camera recorded 3 men entering a storage unit in the Sydney suburb of Padstow, but only 2 came out, dragging a body with them. The next morning, another camera captured the men taking McNamara's boat out to sea, where they dumped Gow's body. It was recovered by police 6 days later. The drugs at the centre of the deadly deal were later discovered in McNamara's car.
Its potential value was between $9 and $19 million.
McNamara's daughter burst into tears as the life sentence was handed down. Her father and his partner in crime will likely die behind bars. Their victim's family says that is a fitting end for the 2 men who took Jamie from them. Mia Burns, 7 News.
Well, there we go, folks. For podcast listeners, Whistleblowers goes on the fringes and brings up stories that are current and in the past. And if you don't know who Roger Rogerson is, he's almost become part of folklore hero and history in Australia to the crime world. Roger Rogerson, born in 1941, is a former detective sergeant of the New South Wales Police Force and now a convicted murderer. During Rogerson's career, he was one of the most decorated officers in the police force, having received at least 13 awards for bravery, outstanding policemanship, and devotion to duty, including the Peter Mitchell Trophy, the highest annual police award. During his time in office, he was implicated in, but never convicted of, 2 killings: bribery, assault, and drug dealing. In 1999, Rogerson was convicted of perverting the course of justice and lying to the Police Integrity Commission. He is also known for his association with other New South Wales detectives, New South Wales, Australia, who were reputed to have been corrupt, including, you might have heard Jennifer talking about some of these names in previous episodes, Ray Gunner Kelly and Fred Krah, and with a number of organised crime figures who Jennifer regularly talks about in her books, Abe Saffron, Arthur Nettie Smith, and Christopher Dale Flannery. Jennifer Stone, she's a crime investigator. She's an investigative journalist, and I call her Australia's Murder She Wrote. She's a prolific writer on the topic of crime, not only in New South Wales, Australia, but throughout the world. And The King's Cross Sting is one of Jennifer's books that you can locate on Amazon. And I listen to Jennifer and ask her what we're going to talk about. And for our dedicated podcast listeners today, we're just going to update you a little bit on the Artful Dodger. Dodger, Roger, the Dodger, Rogerson. In May 2014, which is 6 years ago, Rogerson was remanded in prison after being charged, along with fellow former New South Wales detective Glenn McNamara. They were convicted and they were held in remand for the murder of 20-year-old student Jamie Gower and the supply of drugs. Both former detectives pleaded not guilty in January 2015. Their trial was started in July 2015, but was aborted after 2 days because of the potential prejudice caused after McNamara's then barrister, the infamous or the famous Charles Waterstreet, made a reference to Rogerson killing 2 or 3 people when he was in the police force. So following a retrial, both Rogerson and McNamara were found guilty. I remember the day well. I think all of Australia remembers it well. They were found guilty of murder. In September 2016, both were sentenced to jail for life for the murder of Gower. Both gentlemen have written books and they've been applauded by many politicians and personalities. And you were telling me, Jennifer, about Alan Jones writing the foreword saying what a beautiful citizen Roger Rogerson is, and he should be congratulated. The community is a lot safer with Roger. And I'm wondering how Alan Jones might feel today after all this type of activity. We all make mistakes, Alan. And today I'm interviewing Jennifer Stone about this case. Jennifer, I did ask you today to come in and talk about Roger Rogerson. First of all, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me today.
You're most welcome. We're getting a lot of hits now on the different podcast platforms and people are very interested in your research. And you've been very busy, but last episode we touched on the Roger Rogerson appeal and the Artful Dodger, he's at it again. He's taken a bit of time. He's planned his next move. He's got good legal help. What's been happening in the world of Roger Rogerson?
Roger Rogerson has always claimed he never did anything wrong. And that's what every good crim does. They always plead not guilty at the court case. They always say they didn't do it. But then the evidence has to unroll. So this is based on going into a shed out at Panania, Padstow Way, and walking in with 3 people and coming out with the body bag. So who did it? It was either McNamara or Rogerson. And then once you work that out, then McNamara, his claim is Rogerson did it. And Rogerson's claim is McNamara did it. So who did it?
So who did it is the question that Roger's coming forward with. And they're very, very meticulous in their legal work. They're both ex-detectives. They have good legal help. You were just telling me what we do know, and for those that want to see the CCTV footage that Jennifer's talking about, you can Google Roger's name and you'll see it all there. The various media outlets at the time were after the court case were able to show that footage, and we were all aghast in Sydney and around the world, all us crime nuts, at just how brazen, or, you know, people said how dumb they were to do all of these activities straight underneath these cameras. And we've seen the footage that you're talking about. So they've had a bit of time to plan this. And what you're telling me now is that real estate has been sold, and they're now using the public purse to pay for this.
That's right. So for Rogerson's case, I don't know how McNamara paid. I think he had legal aid back then. Rogerson had a house up Central Coast that he sold to pay for the legals at the time. The house was sold for $555,000. I believe his legals were over $1 million. So you start to think, well, who paid the rest? Maybe Johnny Unique. That's what I got told. But who knows?
Who knows? And also the house in East Hills or Panania that he owned, has that been sold too?
No, I believe it got transferred to his wife's name, Anne Melko. So part of the theory in prison, once they go in, if they're going in for life and maybe other cases will come up, they'll divorce their wife and the wife will keep the house and they'll change it over, and then the proceeds of crime are never touched.
So the taxpayers of New South Wales, the hard-working taxpayers now, are paying for the appeal process, is that right?
Yes, that's right. So Rogerson's been waiting for Glenn McNamara to do all the hard yards and put it up, because he got told, I believe, that they wouldn't hear an appeal for him. So they really thought he was guilty. Whether that's right or not, you've got to have points of law where the case was wrong or new information that didn't go before the courts, and that's what he's working on.
Okay, so that's where we're at. Jennifer's just been enlightening me this morning that the information now has been prepared and has been sent to the coroner or the magistrate. And
The Chief Justice that would have gone in for the appeals. The new statements and information they're relying on had to be before the courts on the 17th of August, and then the new appeal starts on the 22nd of September. Mm-hmm. So I'll just... The major question is, Barrister Windler, who was representing McNamara, he brought up a good point. He said to Roger Rogerson, when you're walking over to the shed on the 20th of May, I'm putting it to you, you checked the right-hand pocket. You did that to check a firearm. Completely untrue, Rogerson answered. Left-hand pocket again missed within the evidence, I thought. So look at that footage of him going into the shed and then you'll see him check his pockets. Was that for a gun? So he was working out where the gun was so he could get it out and allegedly shoot. It's a possibility, because McNamara is saying he never had a gun. He was just doing a drug deal. Was it true? You've got to remember that allegedly Jamie Gayo was talking to the Australian Crimes Commission to get a lighter sentence on something he had done in his past. Now, he was the only son of someone to do with tiles. And in the history, what we got told by Rogerson and by researching, the tiles that were coming in that were feeding allegedly into the ice were thinner tiles, and the ice was packed in the tiles. And then when they were delivered to site, the ice was removed, and that particular drug dealer, who was probably the tiler or on that site, knew to get the tiles, clean out the ice, and then the tiles would be laid. That's why a lot of Meriton apartments have tiles that crack.
Coincidence. If you're in a Meriton development and your tiles are cracking, there's some food for thought. Well, you know, life goes on and time goes on and water has passed under the bridge. And, Jen, this whole case, again, comes down to a missing gun.
Yes, Browning gun. It's a little gun that could fit in a pocket. It's one of the small, a baby Browning gun. It was interesting that McNamara, before the shooting, actually was Googling it. So that shows you he knew that maybe that sort of gun was coming, maybe with allegedly Rogerson, is a thought.
And we know it was a Browning gun, not only from the Googling, but because?
Of the bullet that they found in Jamie Gayo.
Okay, so ballistics have done a good job.
Yes, in matching it. And the ballistics man I talked to at the trial outside, and he was saying that it's the forensics that are pulling a lot of these cases, even the unsolved ones, together now. Because it's just maybe one hair and they can work out whose hair it is now. Or once they build a case on coincidences, they can put so much intelligence that goes in that helps the coincidence get glued together.
And Roger, you were saying, is a red herring in the Mick Drury shooting and something to do with the transfer of money in suitcases.
Yes, well, maybe not that to do with that. But allegedly, Rogerson would go and pick up suitcases, a briefcase, and many of them, if you go through the photographs of King's Cross, you'll see suitcases being picked up. They were all the same. They were a briefcase, and allegedly it was full of money.
And what were they called? Harry's...
Harry's bags.
Harry's bags.
Yeah. But, you know, who was Harry? I don't know. But, yeah, Harry's Bags was one of the companies that was looked at during the Woods Royal Commission.
Right.
Yeah. That links to the $14 million that allegedly the police were paid.
Right.
So you start to think, that's $14 million... And I started to look at the maths. The $14 million in drug drops, you know, like if that's just the sling-off, right?
Mm.
So a shot is $50 for heroin and they're getting $14 million. That's a bloody lot of drugs they're selling. So I started to think and I started to do maths on it and all I could think was these bags of money that had been handed out were actually the takings for drug dealing themselves.
Wow. So we wait now until the 22nd of September and Roger gets his chance to appeal and we are unable to attend the court due to the COVID restrictions in New South Wales, but we will return to this story in coming weeks as the appeal starts. Is there anything else we need to add to that, Jen, or can we move on?
Not really. It will be... I don't believe that the appeal will get up. They'll look at the evidence and they'll go, nah. But that's my opinion. Mm. That's not really the court's. Mm. Because the CCTV proves one of them did it.
One of them did it. So, potties, while you're driving around southwest of Sydney or down near Cronulla Beach, keep your eye out for that... little brown gun, maybe it's floating or maybe it's on the bottom of Bait Bay somewhere. Who knows? But we'll rejoin this story in coming weeks. Stay tuned.
Ladies and gentlemen, what you see tonight is a piece of Australian history. Roger Rogerson is a piece of policing history in Australia.
I am a dead set psycho for sure. I've got proof that I am. I go to a psychiatrist. He's told me I'm a nut. And so I'm paranoid, schizophrenic, psycho.
I was 21 years of age when I first walked into Darlinghurst and then you see, you know, you see Roger Rogerson walk past you and then you think, holy shit, like, that's him, you know?
Having Chopper and myself on the same show, we started off in completely opposite poles, but we come together, we talk about similar things from both sides of the spectrum, with Jacko in the middle.
Not a lot of people got to see Ned Kelly, and what you see tonight is a piece of f***ing history to have these two on the stage at the one time.
So we're listening to a little bit of the tour that went around Australia, Bandits on the Run, and Roger Rogerson in this second segment describes himself as a psychopath. Now, without being able to get his psychiatrist notes, he was sort of doing it in a joking sort of way, but the business of murder is very serious. And what have you got for us there, Jennifer Stone?
Yeah, well, I wrote a little bit about, and I'll just read it out. So I put down the links I had over my research over about 11 years now of researching this industry. So each thug, in my opinion, allegedly has psychopath tendencies, which is a person with a personality disorder indicated by a pattern of lying, manipulating, glibness, exploiting, arrogance, sexual promiscuity, delusions of grandeur, low self-control, disregarded for morality, lack of acceptance of responsibility, callous and lack of empathy to their victims. Yet not one word about the mafia is exposed within a lot of this. And so would Rogerson link in? We wouldn't know. But the two that were exposing allegedly the links to the mafia and how the drugs were moving, one of them's Juanita Nelson, from 1975. She was working on this from 1968. And Donald McKay, murdered and missing July 1977. And he was working on that from like 74 or something when he first started standing for local parliament. And the more he stood for local parliament and local council was the more people started to respect him, and he got leads about the grass castles that were getting built around Griffith and the amount of cannabis that was growing in the area. When Donald McKay exposed it, was $90 million. Now, you think, was that for the whole of Australia? And was that getting shipped overseas? You'd start to wonder.
And you've corrected me on the Roger the Dodger term, you know, coming from a famous fair kid storyteller, the Dodger, the Artful Dodger. But Dodger, Roger, is to do with a car that he drove.
Yes. So when they did the police raid on his house, they filmed his house during it, going through collecting it, evidence to do with the Jamie Gayo murder. When they got to the garage, showed a Dodge. I went, oh no, a Dodge. That was a Dodge was in the Juanita Nelson case. So Eddie Trigg was borrowed a Dodge, and on the back seat by his girlfriend at the time, King explained that it had blood on the back seat, allegedly from Juanita's murder.
Wow, a friend of mine used to, his father used to own a Dodge, and they had a massive boot at the back, and I've got a vision of it in my mind. They were a classic old vehicle, the old Dodge, and no doubt in American Western crime sort of movies, you will see the Dodge as part of like that classic mafia type car being driven around. So Roger, you know, psychopath possibly, locked in a cell with his co-consortor Glenn McNamara. What happened when they were on remand?
So this is quite common. So when they put them in a cell, they'll put them together. They'll give them paper and pens and all sorts of things to help them get talking. And normally at that remand stage, they're trying to work out what to say to not get jailed. And normally they know it's only for a couple of days they'll be together. It may only be 24 hours in some cases. And then they're moved to different prisons to be kept separate till the time of the trial. So allegedly that was the time. You know, a lot of that information came up in the Crown's evidence regarding for the trial for McNamara and Rogerson. So they had the notes. They had some vision about them chatting in prison, working out who did what. Now, that's consorting at a very high level, very sophisticated. You know, like they knew what had happened.
Knew what had happened, and that's what they call spilling the beans. And we'll leave you now with... Oh. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry about that. Rogerson, he's been known for his CCTV footage before to get a conviction.
Yeah.
So Rogerson was convicted of perverting the course of justice in relation to $110,000 deposit by him into bank accounts under a false name. So Rogerson spent 9 months in jail to 1990, and then he put in an appeal, and this appeal was unsuccessful. So Rogerson knows about his appeals can be unsuccessful. On the 17th of February 2006, Roger Rogerson was released from prison Kirkconnell Correctional Centre. So between 2006 and May 2014 was his free time. Hope he enjoyed it.
I hope he enjoyed it too, but we'll leave you now with... Roger's last days of freedom and the reporting.
To a prison van to be driven away a convicted murderer. His one-time mate, Glenn McNamara, reluctant to face that same title. McNamara's eldest daughter, Jessica, missed the verdict. She ran into court in tears a few minutes late, and her distress was amplified as she left.
Rogerson's wife, Anne, wasn't there and was in no mood to talk at home.
Hello, as long as you're there, I'm not coming out of the house.
It was a landmark decision after an extraordinary four-month trial for the murder of the university student, Jamie Gow.
So the poor old women caught up in the life of a psychopath, and we may cover the story behind Glenn McNamara at a later date, but this has been Whistleblowers episode 13. We wait now to for that appeal process to go ahead. Jennifer, did you want to add anything? You've been covering this story for a long time. What do you think will happen to poor old Rog?
Oh, I think it will get dismissed. It'd be interesting if they say we'll, you know, have a retrial, because the retrial will cost the taxpayer, you know, millions. Not just on one side, it will be millions because of McNamara too.
And there we go, Whistleblowers episode 13. We hope you've enjoyed this little update on Roger Rogerson. And we will return next week with another episode of Whistleblowers. Please like us on our social media accounts and add us to your list of crime podcasts. And we'll be updating you in coming weeks on the William Tyrrell case and a little bit more about Gary Jubelin and what he's up to these days. And Jennifer's also doing some research in Canada, so we're hoping to bring you some new information as it unfolds. I'm Greg Kerr.